Welcome to the Nerds Podcast number 513. At Midnight's going on the road. Well, it's not really going on the road. We're just doing a couple shows in Nashville in the middle of May. I believe the 16th and 17th.
That doesn't mean you can't play like Turn the Page and just feel like you're a real haggard road dog.
I know. I'll play that or The Loadout.
Oh, that'd be a good one too.
Little Jackson Browne.
I just figured you was more a guy with a smooth sax line going in your road dog stories.
And Matt Myra's riding dick jokes. And the points will be given, and they've all been given out tonight. And I go back to my room and be alone with the internet. And I congratulate myself for not watching too much TV, but I'm on the internet. So we will be there. I think if you go to Wild West Comedy Festival, well, Google Wild West Comedy Festival and get tickets. Come out and see that. The sponsor of the Nerds Podcast is GoToMeeting by Citrix. With GoToMeeting, you can share the same screen to review documents, presentations in real time, Kyle Clark.
You could review those documents in real time.
Oh, would you please get the loadout? Just load that out.
For the six of you who understand what the loadout is, you're laughing really hard.
You know, I bet you...
For the remainder of the audience.
More people know the loadout.
I normally would agree with you. This one, I feel like, is the stretching point.
Don't leave, Kyle.
Stay just a little bit longer. There's a dad who's sticking his head into his kid listening nerves right now going, hey, this show just got great.
Hey, you didn't tell me there were all these sweet Jackson Browne references. But with built-in video conferencing, Jackson Browne could have used GoToMeeting to stay connected with his family while he was on the road to make it easier for him. It's HD video conferencing. You just need a webcam to see each other face-to-face. You can present, you can demonstrate pretty much from anywhere. With any Mac, PC, tablet, smartphone, millions of people choose GoToMeeting. Start hosting your own face-to-face online meetings today. Try it free for 30 days. Visit GoToMeeting.com, click try it free, and use the promo code Nerdist. That's GoToMeeting.com. Enter the promo code Nerdist. This podcast is Eddie Izzard, who we had on before with a group of people. We had him on with Eric Idle, and we had him on with Billy Connolly when they were promoting the show called What About Dick? And I got to hang out with him a couple of years ago at the Montreal, at Just for Last Montreal.
Got to that Paul Provenza Green Room.
Oh, yeah, the Green Room. So much fun. And
That's one of my favorite episodes of Green Room.
It was really, really... I don't know. There was something just kind of special about it because of the audience was in the right place, and I think all the comics were in the right place, and Paul was in the right place, and it just had a nice...
Super good vibe.
It just clicked and was one of the most fun things that I've ever gotten to do. And I was just in awe of those guys the entire time.
Any room with Eddie Izzard and Jimmy Carr
in the same time. Yeah, like, and then you also have Tim Minchin and Judah Friedlander and Paul Provenza in there as well. So, and then me making dick jokes. But Eddie is promoting his new international comedy tour, Force Majeure. U.S. dates are on sale now at eddieizzard.com. And I mean, you know, it's fucking.
He's doing his closers, his encores in French because regular stand-up isn't hard enough.
Yeah,
anymore.
He does comedy in multiple languages. He's a polymath comedian, Eddie Izzard. But there's no, you know, if you're a working comedian today, there's a good chance that you were influenced in some way by Eddie Izzard. And so the fact that he actually wanted to come on the show, when they said, oh, would you want Eddie Izzard back on the show? I'm like, why would you even ask me that? Just do it. And he was fantastic. So here we go. The Nerds Podcast number 513 with Eddie Izzard.
Watch it or listen to it, I guess, instead right now in your ears.
Ugh.
I know.
Jackson,
I'm not proud of it either.
It's a Jackson Browne out.
That was worth it just to get that pun?
No, it's never worth it.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Welcome to our brick room, a fine place to record audio.
So much creativity comes from places. It's like backstage at things.
Yeah, like a natural reverb and echo.
Yeah, there's everything. And this room is always permanently cold.
What's the heater? What's the heater?
Yeah, there's a heater on because it could be 90 degrees outside, but in here, for some reason, this is just a little mini Arctic.
I don't know what the problem with this room is. I said maybe haunted. Who knows? Who knows?
Yeah, it could be. Could be a lot of people died. Well, in fact, well, this is part of... Have we started?
We've started.
Because this is part of my theory in Force Majeure, which is if you're going to be a tortured soul to die, maybe soul takes it, but if there should be dinosaur ghosts.
Yes.
Yes.
160 million years, they all died... with in a bad way. None of them died in their beds, surrounded by their families, in a good way. And that's and we have been going with 2 million years since we came out of the trees, maybe 5 million years to say human development, 160 million years of dinosaurs, all died badly. Every day, every night, you should be going, there's a huge thing. What's that screaming? Ghostly, you know, it should be tons of it.
Not one haunt. There's not one dinosaur ghost.
It should be.
Well, they don't have. They have, you need unfinished business to be a ghost, right?
Well, they had an entire
in 160 million years. There must have been quite a lot of dinosaurs going. I was going to go and do a poo of it, and I was going to rip that thing's head off,
unless
eat it like a sherbet.
I'll tell you what they did. Unless it. You know, asteroid hits the Earth, kicks up a lot of dust, blocks out the sun. They start choking. It chokes out the dinosaurs. Maybe they just had plenty of time to finalize all their affairs, and they knew they were like, you know, we see it coming. It's, you know, they didn't just
they were plan ahead, kind of imbeciles.
Yeah. Where's the dinosaur version of the movie The Road?
Yeah. I don't know. It's somewhere.
Just one little.
It got crushed. It got killed. We lost a lot of great dinosaur film around 65 million years ago when the asteroids
it just pegged out, and we know that because that thin belt of dark in the thing. But if you're very religious, then pigs rule the world or something. I'm not sure what it is on the religious front. But anyway, you guys are wrong, by the way.
Okay, good. That's fine. Listen, if the internet is to be believed, that is true all of the time. That 100% of the time.
Wait,
I'm wrong.
Which thing?
That I'm wrong.
No, not you guys. I'm going, you guys, religious guys.
They're wrong. Ethan. Oh, okay.
Not
all right.
Guys.
Okay. Oh, thank God. I didn't get to be right
you
for
guys
a change.
Are right.
It was good.
You gave a nod to me when you said religious guys. You said religious guys.
Like, this fucking guy.
Yes, right. No, I was just talking about people who... But, you know, religion, it's the extremist people. They're the people you just got to watch out for. And so I'm just fiddling around here. I'm just trying to stick something in my mouth.
Are you doing busy, is today busy press day?
Well, to an extent, yes. There's a lot. I haven't actually stopped. I've got a gig tonight in English and Spanish. And I'm talking to your good self now. And then I go and do Mr. Craigie Ferguson. And then I'm going to do 60 minutes in English and an encore 15 minutes in Spanish, which doesn't often happen.
Because you do. I know you speak German and French, but I did not.
I started Spanish 2 weeks ago.
How is it going?
I'm up to 15 minutes. But I'm up to 15. You see, I learn the show off by heart like a play. And then I learn the language at the same time. So one, the learning of the show is a memory exercise plus comprehension, because I do understand the words that I'm saying. I do know the show. It is my show that's been translated. And then the learning of the language is comprehension and then memory, because you need to remember
the
things that you're learning as you're going. Quiero, I want. Quiero un agua con gas, con limón, por favor. You know, and you need to be able to remember those words. Otherwise, it's pointless just understanding it whenever you look at it, but going, I don't remember anything. So it's interesting that the things I'm doing on the show is like the flip side of what I'm doing when I'm learning the lessons. So I did a week in Madrid and did 3 hours of lessons every day. And then each night I'd put another 2 or 3 minutes into the show. So by the end of a week I had 15 minutes. Yeah.
Which Los dinosaurios muertos.
Los dinosaurios muertos. Los animales salvajes. Me he dado cuenta que todos los animales salvajes están en forma. All wild animals are fit. This is the thing I've noticed. This is weird. This is blowing totally at me. I'll take it. Can you have it?
Yes, I will take it.
I'm happy to be cool and chill.
I have the soul of an old person. I'm always cold, no matter what. I just don't enjoy the cold.
Oh, I have a warm thing. I don't know. Yeah.
I'm just right.
Yeah. You're the good porridge.
You're the middle bear.
Mm-hmm. I'm always curious about the, you know, obviously... Comedy is universal, so it transcends language. But there are things about it where language...
Well, that's it. You said that, but most people don't say that. Most people don't say comedy is universal. What you have said, I believe, is the correct theory, and I feel I'm proving it as I'm going out, because I'm now in 4 languages. But a lot of people say, the American sense of humor, the British sense of humor, the French sense of humor, the German...
Germans don't have a sense of humor. They say in this kind of casual, I suppose it's casual racism way that we had, probably from World War One, World War Two, we were quite happy to throw that around. But in fact, there are Germans with no sense of humor. There are Americans with no sense of humor. I suppose the Tea Party can't be a sense of humor anyway in there. The British people without sense of humor. Yeah, there's broadly a mainstream sense of humor and an alternative sense of humor in every developed country.
Well, I think it depends on what your points of reference are. And if you're talking about global topics, if you're talking about human topics, then language doesn't, you know, figure in. But if you're talking about, if the basis of your comedy is cultural, like, oh, this American show or this British show,
you're the first person that I've talked to who said my theory back to me. Before,
I'm glad to hear that.
It's great. No, that is very you to do that. but again, you know, this podcast is, you know, I enjoyed doing it last time and you're very on it. But people haven't got there. Like, I've got to this conclusion. You've said this conclusion back to me. It's humor is human and references are national. That's it.
You
could even get a mainstream. It would be a huge project to do. You'd have to get a mainstream comedian who. It'd have to happen accidentally, because mainstream comedians are not going to... They're just going to say, hey, I do these jokes, and everyone in my country likes it, and screw everyone else, and that's it.
Yeah.
But you'd have to get someone who's like that, and then something tragic happened, and then they were transplanted, and then were dumped in another country. They had to learn that language. They learned it all, and then they still were mainstream. They still weren't kind of alternative and out there and progressive, but they were still kind of mainstream, and I like my this, and I like my that. And then they got all their new references from the country, and then they became a mainstream comic in that country. And that would prove the theory, but I don't think you're ever going to get that one to happen.
No, I learned, because I learned to do stand-up in Los Angeles, which is the worst place to learn to do comedy.
For why?
Because it's full of performers, basically, and so you're performing for other performers, and so you develop habits here.
The performers are in the audience.
Yeah, so the performers in the audience, so you it's very self-referential and too quote-unquote savvy of an audience, I'm saying it kind of sarcastically, and so you learn habits that you can't take anywhere else, because the audience has come to shows here and they automatically are already thinking comedy. It's like you don't, I don't know. It's
you could be very postmodern.
Yes, absolutely.
And you could take further jumps and they'll go along with you.
Because they are also performers, and then you're, you know, trying to make performers laugh, it can be very dicey. Yes. And so that's what you learn how to do. And then you can't really apply that anywhere else. So I had to unlearn all of my... First of all, I had to learn how to perform in the rest of America, and then I had to learn how to shed all the America-centric jokes to perform in like Canada and England and other places.
Right, yes. So. But it is, if I now in-head edit when I'm developing stuff, and it tends to be on stage, I don't tend to write it, but I don't know how you do yours. A lot of people seem to do this thing of on stage, and hey, let's go off in this direction.
Yeah.
But when I'm developing stuff, I will block out good ideas that are just going to be too one-country-centric.
Yeah.
And just let them drift away, and or put them on a slight, and put them maybe to be used in that country sometime later, maybe in a chat show or something. I don't know. But
the Python guys used to do shows in German and French, and you know they did other
Most of their stuff was universal, and if they did have a completely British reference, which they did have a number of, what American audiences or maybe German audiences would do, or anyone, they would just look and say, "I don't get that one. That's not even a joke to me." But I don't mind it. I'll wait for the next one to come along. Just like if we're watching The Simpsons and they reference some guy from telly in America.
Right.
Some politician that's on a low ranking that we don't know isn't the president. We just go, and then it moves on.
Right.
You don't actually hear a bell going or a ta-dum thing that says, you should have laughed there, by the way. It's just...
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I watched all of the... I adored The Young Ones when I was in... When we got The Young Ones on MTV in the 80s.
Yeah.
And then that's where I became, you know... Aside from Python, that's where I started becoming obsessed with British comedy. And I didn't get a lot of the... I'm like, oh, that's a local British guy. I didn't know who Cliff Richard was at the time. Yeah. But I knew in context, like, oh, I'm supposed to think that's funny. And so I still thought it was funny because of the way they presented it.
Because Rick Mell loved Cliff and he's going on Cliff. Yeah. And then John Cleese would talk about Dennis Compton. You know how I am? Dennis Compton, who's a cricketer, and you wouldn't know the cricketers, but still you feel he's hit that such a hard thing that Dennis Compton must mean something in this thing, and it can be funny even just for the rhythm of it.
Right.
Yeah.
And their commitment. Like, they're so committed to it that you're like, oh, I'm not... I'm the one who doesn't get it. That's my fault, not their fault. Yeah. So I'm going to find out who that guy is.
Yeah, and I did that reversely with... I played Lenny Bruce on stage, and there was a... You had to not only be interested in comedy. The reason why Lenny Bruce isn't better known is because it was so full of Americana and 50s Americana. He's talking about Nixon... Vice President Nixon in whose administration? In Eisenhower's administration. So you have to know about that. And Sophie Tucker, Americans know Sophie Tucker, not known outside. And a whole lot of, there was some band leader he would always reference. And if you didn't know it, you had to have to read up about people in order to go back and get the joke.
Yeah, exactly.
You've got to be a real student of comedy.
A set full of footnotes.
Yeah.
When the first time I met you was we did the Green Room together, the Paul Provenza show in Montreal.
Yes.
And it was you and Jimmy Carr and Judah Friedlander and Tim Minchin.
Yeah.
And it was a fucking great panel. But at that time you were saying. You said I'm gonna go into politics. I want to make changes. I really feel like and it sounded like who better to go into British Parliament than a comedian?
I don't quite say that though. I don't quite say I'm gonna make changes because I'm kind of I'm very careful with how I articulate.
Okay,
it.
I'm sorry. I'm
no,
sorry.
No, it's okay. But it's an interesting point because I think people will think I'm gonna come in with a broom and I'm gonna change everything and I put cheese in the. On the walls, and, so I don't say that. But what I do say is, look, if you look, from running marathons to doing gigs in different languages to telling everyone I was a transvestite to playing Hollywood Bowl and gigs in German, I do things which are not on the list. That's why I like doing things that are not on the list, and it's interesting, and it's positive, and it's open-handed politics as opposed to the closed fist of the extremists. And I will bring that to politics, and then whatever I can do, I will do. I don't know quite what I'll be able to do. I might not have enough power to be able to do things. People might expect, oh, everything will change. But then if you get to be mayor of London, which is I'm trying to get to, you're in charge of police and transport, essentially. It's not as much powers as the mayor of New York has. So, but you cannot change schooling. You cannot change taxes. You cannot fund this thing left, right, and center. There's only a certain amount of things you can do. So I will keep my powder dry on the idea of I'm going to come in and set fire to people's trousers. I'm just not going to do that. But I will, I will try to do what I can in a positive way. But I like people. I'm a radical centrist, a social democrat. I like the safety net of people having a tough time. But I like entrepreneurship. I like business. Invent stuff. Go stuff. I've taken my creative medium and comedy built in Britain and drama. The drama I'm doing is all comes out of Britain. That's where I developed, and then I'm taking it around the world and I'm putting it into interesting places and gigs in Moscow, St. Petersburg, Istanbul, gigs in German, French, Spanish. It's and then Russian and Arabic to come. So that's what I will put into it, that energy. But at the moment, I haven't got this policy, that policy, and I'm not going to change the world because I want to keep the bar low. Because, it can be difficult. You get in and then the other team is going to try and stop everything you do.
Yeah,
that is the thing. Whereas in comedy, you just try and do stuff and your other comrades of comedy, they don't actively try and stop you. They just say, well, I'd like to get a show as well. And you want to get a show and this guy wants to get a show. But
right.
No one's trying to say, I'm going to block his show by briefing against him. He smells this guy. I wouldn't give him a show.
Okay. Eddie Izzard wants you to think the dinosaurs are ghosts. Well, there's no campaign commercials.
Yes, exactly.
The British press is horrifying to me. Like the British press, because I feel like there's a very steep shame cliff that happens where if the British press decides like, oh, we think you're we're just gonna fucking make you look like an asshole right now on that. I know American press can do that as well, but for some reason British press is a little scarier to me.
It is, but our TV is okay, which is interesting. And the power of the right-wing press has disintegrated. Maybe it's too strong a word. It's definitely diminished. I was there when the Sun newspaper, which is a right-wing newspaper, came landed in the middle of the Labour Party conference. I'm a member of the Labour Party. It said, we're backing the other team, and you're going to have a tough time, or you're not going to make it. And And they didn't even get a majority in the last election, so which is amazing. They were supposed to get a landslide, and they only got 50 more seats than we did. So ground war stayed up. The work we did on the ground, the knocking on doors, getting the vote out, the core vote of the Labour Party stayed up. So it was so it was good. We've got another election in a year in May, and we'll see what happens then.
Now you seem to be fascinated by politics, but I wouldn't say, oh, Eddie Izzard, he's a political comedian.
No, I kept it out. So I do social politics, sexual politics, historical politics, but no party politics. It dates like crazy. You say something on one day, it could date by the next day.
Yeah.
So that's just practically useless.
Yeah.
Why not talk about that? And also, I just thought I'll do all the comedy that I normally do, talking about the condition of humanity in the comedy, and then I can do the politics in the politics, keep them in separate bags.
Applying the concept of politics to other sectors is pretty interesting, because essentially everything has some type of balance of power. Like everything has some type of, right? Isn't there some, here you say social politics, or, you know,
right,
that essentially breaking, that's what I always loved about Python, was like, here's the politics of, you know, the afterlife, or here's the politics of this thing. It's basically taking bureaucracy or structure or whatever, and then you know, peeling back the curtain for anything other than...
Well, looking for logic. I mean, in the show, because, you know, this is all about... I'm here to talk about this tour. I'm trying to play all 50 states of America, but on this, I think we're playing half of them or something like that. So it's all the way from Chicago down to Texas and eastwards of that. Unfortunately, on the West Coast, I'm not getting here yet. But... human sacrifice is what I start off with, and I just was wandering around on stage developing, because I developed it in San Francisco and here in LA and in New York, and I came up with human sacrifice, and I thought, this is a perfect place for my kind of intelligent but silly humor, very Python influenced humor, to go to, because I play in a childlike way, but human sacrifice is quite a hellish, what the hell were we doing? Now, and it's also a non-blamable thing, so no party's going to come and say, oh, you're blaming us for human sacrifice, because it's actually, we've gone beyond that place, which is great, but humanity did that, certain shades of it. But if you think about it, it is crazy. Why? Because I point out that if when we were farmers, if the crops were bad and the weather had failed, then you would try and please the gods. You would do maybe a dance for the thing, for a sun dance, a rain dance, whatever you're needing. You do give an offering, maybe bake a cake, do a thing, draw a picture, I don't know, something to please the gods. But who said, you know, the gods are angry, let's kill Steve? And it doesn't make any sense. Why would the gods who put these people on the planet say, can you smash one or two of them up and so they're all broken, please? Because wouldn't you think, by doing that human sacrifice, the gods would be incredibly angry? There's no logic to them saying, yeah, we put them on the earth and yeah, cut them up, and blood everywhere, that's fantastic. It's a right-wing idea.
Also, Steve's a dick.
Well, I also think, like, let's say I had 12 dogs, and then I was kind of curious as their master, like, I want to test their loyalty, so one of the dogs kills one of the other dogs, and I go, yeah, he's on my side, you know? Like, he's willing to snuff out one of the other ones, so I'm still in control. So this idea of, like, you know, a god having domain or gods having domain over, you know, humanity is the idea, maybe, that, see, we'll do anything for you, even murder someone, and we kind of like this guy.
Well, I can see people coming up with reasons, but there's still no logical reason.
No one
can say, unless the god's going to come down. And remember, no god has ever come down. The son of God, the daughter of God, the uncle of God has come down, but no god's ever popped down and said, by the way, I am here. And
this is a dirty place, though, you know?
It's
a filthy place. Why would they want to get their feet
there? That is a nice place. It can come down and put the Garden of Eden. And that's why the snakes... Remember, you know, in the new film Noah, when there's a thing in the trailer when all the snakes are coming towards the ark. I don't know if you see, there's just a clip. There's a lot of snakes coming in. That's when, if I was Noah, I'd go, okay, I think we got everything.
They don't, what do they do?
Snakes are coming. No, I'm not sure. That'd be fine.
Yeah, yeah.
There's not they a lot of room.
Swim.
Yeah, we got all these
land fish.
I'm not sure if those snakes were really nice.
What I perceive to be a lot of what your comedy is genuinely you trying to understand things. Mm. Whereas I'm sort of going through this period where I'm sort of talking about things that happen with my dad, You seem genuinely curious about things in terms of do you actually discover answers in your quest for comedy? It seems genuinely are curious.
Well, I think on that human sacrifice thing, I think whoever said "Let's kill Steve" was the first fascist. You know, it's where they manipulated logic into saying let's do that. Like the Jewish Bolshevik conspiracy was utter rubbish from the moment he said it. From even, and he picked up ideas that were already existing. And Jewish people are being demonized because they're supposed to be all about money. Bolsheviks were hated because they were supposed to be not into money. So what kind of conspiracy between the people who are totally into money and the people who are not into money was supposed to happen? It's an illogical conspiracy from the moment he thought it up. He just said it over and over again, screamed it, got into power, and then started murdering people. So
I think there's I think it's the same mental gene that OCD comes from, where it's where does people like, oh, I'm in this situation where I don't have any control, so I'm going to start making weird connections to things to give myself the illusion that I have control over the elements. Right. So it almost seems like an extension, these types of things, like maybe another Steve at another time just accidentally died and they're like, the crops got better, so they went, well, now we got to fucking kill someone every year Steve. At this time.
Yeah.
So that New Year's Steve for New Year's Steve. But maybe it is an extension of that kind of, you know, this OCD thing.
It could be. I mean, it's just extremists come up with simplistic answers. The one-stop answer, do this X, and then everything will be fine. It doesn't work. Real politics is complicated, which is why it pisses all us moderates off, because there are so many decisions to make. There could be 8 ways of going on a thing. Yeah. And it's got to be, maybe you've got to do 2 of them and a bit of one of the other. But you've got to make a decision and drive forward. And sometimes the decision you've got to do is actually not to make a decision and to wait. And that drives people crazy. But if you watch Lincoln, you can see where he could not make that. He couldn't push it. He had to spin as they were going down, as the conservative part of the Republican Party were, and the Republican Party was really the Democratic Party at that point. They were going down. The names is like spun around. So the Conservative Party is going down to the South to try and get peace to happen, and he's got to let them do that because then they will support and vote for his 13th Amendment and get to eradicate slavery. But he knows that if they do come up and these people from the South come up and they make peace, then you will not get this through. Congress. So he had to do this really tricky thing. And if you watch Lincoln, that's what real politics is. It's really difficult. So the truth of it is really difficult. That's why it annoys everyone, because it can get in really stuck.
In a lot of different places,
yeah.
too.
And then extremists come in with a beguiling politics. It says, no, let's just do all this and we'll kill all these people. And then they don't start off with kill. They just say, look, we'll move. That's what Hitler said. We'll move them to a nice place that's somewhere. Where? Oh, sorry. Where was that? Oh. And will they have nice houses? Yeah. Ish. And then murder, death. And that's what they said. The Jewish people got on the trains feeling they were going to camps. They were going to be housed in just a different way. And it was in a different place. And it wasn't going to be bloody murder, which is what it was. And that's what the extremists covered. They come up with murder, and those are their answers. So the moderates of us, we've got to... A lot of us don't get to stand up and be counted, don't become activists and don't go and get elected. And then the extremists come in with a ton of money. Your politics is awash with money now. And what the Supreme Court is doing, I do not know. But they're taking off all the hinges and all the stops on the money. It's just going to be... it wasn't decided by money. That was the interesting thing. Your last election was not decided by the billions and billions that came from these special interest people.
So, well, I think people just want... People... I think there's a lot of... There are many things happening in our culture right now, which is that people's attention... Well, and first of all, humans have a predisposition to just having things simple and be comfortable. Convenience. We want convenience.
Yeah.
And so... But in the midst of the convenience... Our attention's being pulled in a million different directions because we always have our face in our phone. There's, you know, we have access to all of the information all the time.
No.
And I don't think we have evolved to process that. And so I think people now, maybe more than ever, are like, oh, is that a simple answer that's just that or that? Or I don't care what the I'll just take the you know, because it's just simpler for them to process rather than to actually do the due diligence.
It can hurt your mind. You watch someone on the telly and the politician, and one says X and the other says actually it's Y, and you say, well, no, it's X. Well, no, it's Y. Well, it's X, but it's not. And then you go, okay, I'm going to watch something else now. Because and if it's a moderate argument, then you can say, well, they're not that far apart. The extremists obviously are off with the fairies, but you have the Tea Party, named after the Mad Hatter's Tea Party in Alice in Wonderland, I believe. So.
Well, I obviously I've been watching you for a really you're very much a part of my comedy development, I think. What I'm interested in the lifespan of a comic is that by the time Dressed to Kill came along, that was like your fifth special, right?
I think it was actually then Unrepeatable, Live the Battle, Unrepeatable, Definite Article. Then it's I think it's fourth.
Fourth,
yeah.
So we're at that point. When did you? You must have started in the late '80s, I would imagine.
88 was my first gigs, like March 88.
I was doing stand-up. And so what was the stand-up comedy scene in England like? Because in the 80s, that's kind of, that's a couple years away from the end of the massive comedy boom in the United States.
Yes, so it was interesting. You had this massive thing. We had a slightly weirder thing. But it kind of helped us in a way. We didn't have the crash. You had the boom and a crash, yeah? And we didn't have the crash. We had a lot of franchising. People going to make money. We had a lot of enthusiasts opening rooms above pubs due to... it took 79 was the beginning, and it was a separation. Also, we did this thing which America has, comedians have done, but I don't know if it actually was the alternative comedy scene started in 79, and it took over mainstream. We said we were different to what mainstream comedy is. Mainstream comedy was, hey, my wife, you know, not saying, you know, it was all this my wife joke and my mother-in-law and all this kind of mainstream thought, and they're not based on life.
Yeah.
And then 79, it was a post-punk thing that started. It was non-sexist, non-racist, built into it, even though some people came into this who were kind of, could be sexist or racist, or in a very, in a hyper-postmodernist way, or sometimes just out and out, and so that was all kind of confusing. But it grew up in the 80s. It was all over the place. It was kind of called the cabaret scene. People had strange, unusual acts. A lot of more special acts were in there. The guy called the Iceman, he used to melt a block of ice in different ways.
So there was performance art within the comedy community.
Exactly so. And then, towards the end of the 80s, going into the 90s, it became stand-up. Everything dropped out. We all just sort of took over because we could just turn up and do things really quick. We all started doing 4 gigs on Friday, 4 gigs on Saturday. There are 60 to 80 clubs in London. It's the biggest club scene in the world, and it has been since 1990. So it's just, and it's an accident. It's not because we're brilliantly something or other. What America would do with these rooms above pubs, they were taverns, and people were traveling back in the old days, and the breweries all bought them, so they all had a lot of money because they were selling drinks, and they left these rooms as function rooms for weddings, whereas I think in America they say, we've got to turn them into condos, we've got to make an office space. It's wasted space here. Some bean counter would have changed it, but the breweries owned all these places, so they were making so much money they didn't really care. So then someone came along and said, Tuesday night, you're not using it Wednesday or Thursday, and why don't I take one night, I'll take the door, you take the beer money. And the guy said, fine. So not making a huge amount of money. There's only a couple of clubs that have their own bars and stuff like that, and there's just a lot of amateur semi-pro guys running these places, and it's fantastic. You can just zip around, do 4 or 5 gigs of a night, so we could just do hours and hours on stage.
Were there audiences at every show, or were they like
sometimes down to 10, 15, but
there was always somebody there.
Yeah, and good standard as well. You knew that certain ones had reputations. If you go there, usually good people are on, but not known people. So you could have a whole night of unknown people. Still, the Comedy Store, you go there, and the people who are headlining or playing all the way through there, you wouldn't really, this is a Comedy Store in London, you wouldn't really know who they are, but you could guarantee these are going to be top of the line people who are going to make you laugh.
Yeah.
And now it's spread all around the country. And we don't have a film industry, and we do have a TV industry, so you can get into sitcoms and panel games. But and now we're doing chat shows as well, which you've had comedians doing chat shows since the 50s. We only got it since the late 90s.
Oh wow!
Yeah, because we had a sort of Charlie Rose equivalent guy called Michael Parkinson. He was the godfather of interviewing, and he was a journalist. So it was the idea of you've got to be a journalist and have this style. And he had a great style, and it was very inquiring and a great conversationalist. But the idea of a comedian doing it was just not on anyone's radar.
Yeah.
And then one took off. Graham Norton, I think, was the first one really to take off. And they said, we just got to put comedians in it. Oh, my God, America did that 50 years ago. So we all learn, you know, like you take French films and put them in things, and sometimes we do game shows, or you know, like find a monkey in a, whatever these things are. You know, Britain's next, American Idol came from Pop Idol. Yeah. So we all just borrow off each other. In the end, we're all humans, and you know, as I travel around the world, I realize there is no difference. I knew this anyway. I still can't prove it to the hating people who will hate and say these people are totally different. But I like going around making the connections. I don't know how I've got all the way around to this again, but yes,
It's good because the show that I did for Comedy Central is very much a British show, which is basically it's a topical comedy game show. So it's like, oh, three comics, we pull topics off the internet and we kind of make fun of them in a game show fashion. But that's you have a ton of those in England, and we have none except for ours here.
No, exactly. The weird thing is, at some point, America's going to work out that panel games cause Zip to put on and they make a ton of cash and get, you know, what's it? Have I Got News for You? In its 26th year. They are cash cows of a huge degree, and they're all over Britain. And no one in America has quite said, I'm going to put one in and say, it's got to have someone high up the tree. It's going to say, we're going to put this one. If that doesn't work, we'll put this one on until we get one. Once you get one, it'll knock the doors open.
Yeah. I think a lot of the principles that America struggles with that are sort of British in nature are difficult because we're such a big fucking country that it's very, I feel like in England you're a little more focused. It's like this is this community and this is, it's a little bit smaller and tighter.
We're like the East Coast really, or even half the East Coast, you know. It's just smaller land.
We have too many different sensibilities stitched together.
And we've got
together.
60 million, you see. But, so that's a fifth of your size of your country. But your country is two or three times bigger than Europe. So you've got this massive spread.
Yeah. It's like a bunch of different countries.
Yeah, and you've also got all these states in the middle where people, all the young, brightest and wisest, or the liberals, or the people who care, seem to get the hell out and go to the edges. So that's a curious thing. So you have this voting thing that is much more skewed to the right because of the middle of your country, people keep leaving.
You'd be surprised. Like California is actually pretty conservative.
Yeah, because of Orange County and then Northern California.
Well, it's all the parts in between. It's like L.A., San Francisco, and then that's pretty much it. Everything else is, you know, everything else is pretty conservative.
But it's still conservative. Democrat, though.
It's pretty close. Like
Orange County is basically a red state.
And San Diego too, I would imagine.
Yes.
Yeah. And anything south of Los Angeles and in between Los Angeles and San Francisco and then north of San Francisco.
I was in Oklahoma City and a girl saw that I was from California, like a waitress, and she's like, oh, you're from California, take me with you. I've always wanted to go to California. She was saying California as a blanket statement, and I was trying to explain to her, I was like, you know, most of California is like Oklahoma, just farms and flat and boring and racist.
How long are you in the States for?
I'm going to be touring. So the tour starts on the 30th in D.C. And then it's all the way up to the 2nd in San Antonio. And then I fly to see the Python gigs in London.
Oh, man. Oh, wow. That's fantastic.
Yeah. And the 20th of July could be the last Python gig ever. So if people want to see something, they've got to get there by the 20th.
I love when the last time you were on, it was you, Eric Idle, and Billy Connolly, and Sophie...
Winkleman.
Yes. And you guys were promoting What About Dick, and Eric Idle, who is amazing, it's weird to say I feel bad for the Python guys, but people still just like, you know, when he was like, you know, that was like just a couple years of our lives and career, and then but that's the thing that everyone's like, oh, this sketch and that sketch. And
really, well, it was 4 years of that, so 69 to 73, I think, so it's 4 years of that, but then they came back and they did first a film collection of sketches, which they refilmed. And then they did the second film, is Holy Grail, which took off in America, because the first film didn't take off, and after something completely different. And then, so that takes you into, what again, 70s, going into the 80s, and then Life of Brian was huge, and there was a big scandal, because they were saying, hey, you know, there could be some people, you know, it wasn't about the life of Mr. Yeshua, because Yeshua's the guy whose Greek name is Jesus, so... I don't think if that guy really was the son of God and he came down, he'd say, why are you calling me by the Greek version of my name? You know? His name was Yeshua. This is historically out there. And then everything was written down in Hellenic Greek. And so they wrote Jesus. So that's what they did that. So it was, I think the Python career was slightly long. It was initially 4 years. And then there's the tapes and the albums, and then those films going all up into the early 80s. So it does It does feel like 15 years.
Do you think they're still okay with it, or do you think they're like, let's just do these one more time?
There's got to be a certain edge of what's actually going to happen, how's it going to actually play. But, they all can do it. They are my comedy gods. It's how up for it they are to do it. You know, they just got to go for it.
Yeah.
If I was them, I would do a week or two somewhere just before they go on. I don't know if they're going to be around it, but I'd just get on a small stage somewhere and get themselves bloodied and up and running. Yeah. Before they hit the stage, just put them in a better frame of mind.
Doesn't it make you happy that you're just a stand-up and that you don't have to rely on a few other people to like get together to, you know?
Well, I was in a four-person theater group, so I do, you know, because we were just trying to be Python when I was in the early 80s. That's why I took up the Edinburgh Festival. So it was four. I was a four-person group, and all the arguments went on with four. They had six, now five. And then I was two. All the arguments were just with two people. We used to have meetings to discuss. Me and my partner Rob, we'd have meetings to discuss when we could meet. To discuss, we say, let's have a coffee to go and discuss when we could meet to discuss what we could change in the show to improve it, and can we be bothered, or should we just do the same old stuff? Because, you know, it was when I was doing street performing, and it's really difficult to come up with stuff for street. You can't write street stuff. You can't say, I'm going to talk about hedges today. You just can't do it. Whereas on the stage, you can just say, I'm going to talk about hedges.
Why is that? As a street performer, do you have to...
Well, as a street performer, what happens is attention spans change. Adults become like children. Children become like animals. So, as you know, very few animals have a good attention span. You can't keep them interested in anything. They're off with stuff. If you're in a room, like here we're in a room, so everyone is kind of forced to listen to what is going on. You could zone out of it, but you can't go and have a cup of tea. Or if you're watching in a show, if they get up and have a cup of tea, that's a complete statement of I'm leaving this show.
Right.
But there is the seats are regimented so that you're going to watch the show, and so that's it. And the lights are down, the focus is on you, the lights are on your face, out in the open air. People don't even know you're doing a show sometimes. I've had people walk slowly, casually through a show that I was doing with my partner because you're going, what are you doing? And they're going, what are you saying? What am I doing for you? You're just someone standing there. And he's saying, you're standing on my props, man. You know, and there's some people on the other side of them. They're just oblivious to it because you hadn't set up a good edge. You actually have to learn the human wrangling. You have to actually get people to stand at an edge, and then people will fill up behind it, and then you get a show going. And it's a completely weird thing to do. But it meant that I could play Hollywood Bowl, because what I learned there was playing in the open air with no one paying any attention, big open space. And then my training for Hollywood Bowl was 4 weeks. No, it was 11 weeks doing shows in French. And then I did four shows on the roof of this building, which is in Bexhill-on-Sea, this little seaside town where I grew up. And I did four little shows there, and then I did Hollywood Bowl. So that was...
Is Hollywood Bowl too many people for a comedy show?
It is perfect. The Greeks got it right. The amphitheater works. 15,000 is great. It's just... You should do... I encourage other comedians to do Hollywood Bowl, because I claimed I was the first person to do a solo act in there, because you know comedians have played it before, but I claimed I was the first person to go and do the whole thing, and they checked LA Philharmonic and they said, no, it's right, you are.
Oh, so, really?
Oh yeah, because no one's there's four. I'm the fourth person to play at Madison Square Garden, and the first in Hollywood Bowl. But I want other people to play it. I want Jerry Seinfeld to go play it. There's other people who can play it, and it's a beautiful gig. The comedy rolls down the hill into your face. Right. The laughter does. It just works.
But don't you have to? Do you have to alter your? No. You don't have to alter anything.
No. All the arena gigs I've done, you don't alter because the screens carry it to the back, and the sound. You have good sound people, good screen people, and it just carries it up to the back. The best view can actually be from the back of Hollywood Bowl or any arena, because you see the whole event and you can see everything clearly.
When you're playing a club, though, occasionally you have this thing where it's like, oh, that four-person table is not into it, or they're not paying attention, so I'm going to focus on that. But when you're doing an arena, it's like the second loge is weird. Like, do you not?
I don't look at anyone in any gig. And when I was street performing, I could see everyone. But I found as I went in, I would always focus on the people. As you said, that table's not into it. So I don't do it because they could be just bad humorous people. And you've got to get with the fact that your humor is some of the bestest stuff going. And so if someone's pegging out, they could be tired, their family could have just exploded. You don't know what's going on. So I just ignore that, and I drive and I live with the energy. I can feel where they are, whether they're with me or not, but I'm not going to go on one group, one thing, who are not in there. And then it's just one big mass of one. It's one person. It's really one big person.
It's just one throbbing organism, yes, that you're playing
that's,
to.
That's what I'm playing to. I'm not playing to a lot of collective individuals.
Do you write a lot on stage as it's happening? I mean, do you just sort of go, well, I want to talk about, you know, I want to talk about dinosaurs, or I want to talk about, you know,
God and fish.
God and fish and all these things. Yeah. And then do you just start talking? Is that how you're able to?
I have the set list, and then I just go on and play.
But do you write, do you actually write things down, or do you go, these are some ideas that I have, and then you work it out on stage?
No, the show, like, I've developed this show doing work in progress gigs, you know, force majeure, so I work that out in LA, San Francisco, New York, doing those each night, going, oh, what about this, what about that, and I'll do that. And I was doing the old show as a sort of backup to give people a decent show, and then I'm adding stuff, and, oh yeah, I've got 20 minutes now, that's decent, that's a bit weird, that stuff, that isn't working, you know, so I would build that up. And then once I've got the show, once the tour started, that was the show, and then I was refining that, but then I just ad-lib off as much as I want. I like to, you know, we're the only ones who see every show that we do, so it's good to, I try and keep it loose and conversational. But with certain pieces which are structured, because I think, well, that's the best way that that bit works to get the laugh to work, to get the idea through.
Yeah.
It took me ages to work out how to explain the problem I had with human sacrifice. I had to say, just follow my logic here. This is that humans, we had fields, we had problems, and I could understand people praising gods, but who said the crops have failed, let's kill Steve? That's a right-wing idea. That's not from humanity. That's from extremists.
And then you just try, and then you're free to just keep tagging it out as much at each show until you find little nuggets, and then you that one, not that one.
Yeah, and I can, it's like pruning a hedge or certain trees. You expand out and it grows out and the stuff grows out, and then you should prune it back, prune it quite hard back, cut it back to a smaller thing, and that should be really the good stuff. And then it grows up again and grows up again, and then you prune it back. It works like gardening.
Basically. I'm bad at pruning, because there's comics like John Mulaney, who, do you know, are you familiar with John Mulaney?
I haven't seen.
It's fucking amazing, but every word that comes out of his mouth is the perfect word. He just doesn't waste any words, and it's just, oh, that's the perfect, you've reduced it, it's like Picasso, it's like if you just reduced it to the minimum number of things that it needed to be.
And is he a very precise comic?
Very precise. He doesn't, there's no stammering, there's no anything, it's just, these are all of the words that were meant to be in this order, and they're perfect.
Yes.
And, you know, I say a lot of words, I feel like, am I not confident enough in my joke writing that I have to talk so much to trick people into not seeing?
No, I think it's the world is big enough for all these different styles. And some people, because you might find you have more gears. Some people are very precise, might get stuck in a night that's kind of a bit weird, and then they may not have the gears to be able to adjust in things. I'm not sure how it works, but I do know that I wanted to have gears so that I could do this. I could do a tight show in a night with a god, they're kind of crazy. They just hit them because they're going off, and some of them it's drunk and just wants to shout at you and tell you to piss off. So, and then some nights where you say, hey, they're with me, so let's fly, let's go over here, let's do that, let's pull it back, let's ram it into them. What do you have? There was a show I was doing up in Canada. So, where was it? No, this was in. Is it in Germany? Is it in Germany or Madrid? It could have been in German or Spanish. And somebody was just repeating. So I just thought, I'm going to steamroller them. I got a steamroller technique. Because you deal with hecklers, you know, people are being weird with you. And then if they're just, okay, they're drunk, they're not taking any, they're not feeling the fact that I've actually already defeated them twice in battle. So, right, I'm just going to steamroller them. And then while they're shouting anything out, you're just going over and there's laughter coming back, going, and then eventually they just tire out, fall into a puddle of their own misery. That's the game plan.
Those are pretty rare, though. I feel like that heckler's pretty rare. I feel like most people just want to help. They're like, oh, I'm a part of the show. I get to talk to Eddie Izzard on stage.
No, it is rare. I mean, you know, just occasionally you get people who are just happened to mosey on up and get the wrong ticket.
There's one. I feel like it's pretty rare though that you get that chaotic evil person who decides, I am going to dismantle this head to toe. I want to tear this down. I feel like that's pretty rare.
They can't really, because we've all had more experience at talking to them, and the audience is on our side. So.
Yeah.
So that, and they haven't got a microphone either. They have got none of the tools.
And especially if you're at the Hollywood Bowl, like one person would have to shout pretty fucking loud without a microphone, without an amplification device to affect the show
it's
in any way.
It's not really going
to
work.
So what now with Force Majeure, how is the is your writing I mean, is it all feel the same? Does it feel familiar? How do you keep challenging yourself when you've...
Because I improvise as much as I can in every show.
Oh, wow.
So that's the thing. So you have the... I know the motorway route. I know the... You call it the freeway route?
Sure.
Highway route. And I know where that's going. But meanwhile, I just keep going off on side routes and going, oh, look over here. Look over there. Then I come back on the road and off we go again. That's how I do it. And then expand it out, prune it back. And then practice. Because I'm going to stop in Chicago. And I'm going to fly to the 70th anniversary of D-Day in Normandy. And I'm going to get there for that day. What day of the week is it? Anyway, it's the 6th of June. And so I get there about 11 in the morning. So I fly to Charles de Gaulle in Paris. Car takes me to Normandy, north of France. Get out. I'll try and be part of some of the commemorations of everyone who fought there 70 years ago. And then at 7 o'clock, I'll do an hour in German. At 8 o'clock, I'll do an hour in English. And then at 9 o'clock, I'll do an hour in French. And I have to practice that as I'm going with my brother on Skype because he's the language expert. So I'm going to work with Mark, my brother, on that stuff so I can get down there and do these three gigs in one night. And hopefully, if you thought about people fighting 70 years before, even some people on the German side who might have thought Hitler's crazy, but I'm forced to do this because I'm a German person, so I have to fight. Maybe they might have thought this is a positive thing some idiot's going to do in 70 years to gig in German and French and English. And they could have all sat down and watched it.
But it's kind of this idea that sort of the comedy is this thing that kind of unites, people can come together and experience comedy, and that's a very communal experience. But to do that, straddling those three cultures, that actually gives it meaning. Like, it's not just... Well, I'm going to do this for the fuck of it. Like, that's kind of nice.
I think it's kind of crazy. And then as soon as I finish, I have to get in a car. I drive back to the airport in Paris. I sleep for a few hours, get on a plane, fly back, and do the gigs in Chicago. So that's the plan.
Ugh.
But you ran 27 marathons in like a month, right?
No, it was 43 in 2 months.
Okay. 43, not as impressive.
Never mind.
43 in 51 days. But, you know, though that's just marathon running. And, you know, we can all do more than we think we can do. And I've decided I'm going to set myself up. I think humans are pretty good with missions. And you can set yourself a positive mission. You can actually set yourself a negative mission. And that was, I think, the problem with Hitler and German. The German people weren't naturally Nazi. But he said, it's all going to be for Fatherland, for us. Remember, we lost the World War, and come on, let's go get that back. And don't we have some people over here who speak German in the next country over, and some people over there, and come on. And so it all spun around, and it got them all on a mission, and they got really good at fighting, you know. And that was a big tragedy, and it all blew up. But Nelson Mandela is someone you can get on a mission to save for freedom, for black people, to get the vote. That's the kind of mission. Mohandas Gandhi, you know, I think humans are good with missions. You just got to try and choose the right one, please. And so this is my mission is open hand, the open hand of politics. So you reach out across into the next culture, into the next language, instead of the closed fist, which is the extremists of saying, push off, back off. Who are you? I hate you people. That's all the right wing politics. So yeah, mine's open handed.
So what is it about your personality you think that makes you want to tackle all of the unlisted stuff? You're like, oh, I got to do this, and I want to try this, and I want to do this crazy
stuff off the list.
Because I
think, you know, as comedians, we have a certain list of certain things we've got to do. You get a program on television, or you get a film, and everything. But the gigs in French, German, they're not on the list. The Russian and Arabic to come, that's not on the list. Hollywood Bowl wasn't on the list. You know, saying you're a transvestite isn't on the list, but it's, I don't know, it's, I'm quite, I like people. I like the vast majority of us. I'd like to give all of us the time of day. You meet someone, someone drops a bag, you want to try and... I just think most people are great. You know, the extremists can all piss off, but the rest of us... I'm good. Because you can be glasses half full, glasses half empty. I'm glasses two thirds full, baby. I'm glasses two thirds full, and so I just, and I want us to make it. I want us to, you know, I want us to live beyond the end of this century. So we've all got to get a decent living. And I was born in Yemen. I was born in Aden in Yemen, and they have a very tough time there, and it'd be great to do gigs in Arabic. Go to Cairo, go to Beirut, and do gigs there. And then some Arabic kid's going to go, well, if that English guy, that British guy's doing it in Arabic, I'm going to do it in English, or I'm going to do it in Russian. And there's already this Edinburgh Festival. We've got a French guy going in, Yassine Belhous. He's going to do an hour in English. That's the first time ever it's happened, I think. Igor Mirsen from Russia doing an hour in English. Francesco De Carlo doing an hour in English. Oh, wow. And Michael Mittermeier.
Oh, I know Michael Mittermeier.
Yeah, yeah. He's doing an hour in English as well. And Henning Venn is the German guy who's playing all through Britain. He lives in Britain, and he's been playing. He's on panel games now. He's the guy who kicked the doors open. He just, you know, Bevan said, the Germans have no sense of humor. This was a German guy who started making everyone laugh, and he turns up on chat shows and panel games
I met him at that Montreal, I think, that year that we were there. There were a bunch of international comedians who in their own countries were like fucking huge. Mm. But then in Montreal, it's like they didn't, you know, it seemed like it was kind of cool for them. Because they kind of had to work for it a little bit again. And not like you don't have to work for it no matter what level you're at. But, you know, if you're a huge comic, the people come into the show with some, you know, like they want you to win.
Yeah.
But if they have no idea who you are, there's a little bit more like, you better make me laugh.
Yes, I get a fairly... I'm lucky when I'm going to these new countries because of the internet and people. I've been putting subtitles on my DVDs for ages and in up to 17 languages. And so I'm going into Madrid, and there's already Spanish people going, we know what you do. So I don't have to come in unknown.
Yeah.
It's this unusual thing. The internet has made it, since 2007, has really made it. So I go to Berlin, and they say, yeah, we know you do this crazy stuff.
How do you stay focused? Because anyone with anyone who has a measure of sustained success, it's never accidental. That person works incredibly hard.
Yeah.
So how do you maintain focus, and how do you, you know, when you have these missions, or if you, I mean, I think the,
well,
I,
that's the thing. Sorry.
I'm sorry. Yes. Okay.
The mission is the thing. If you're floating along and you have an agent manager who's going, what do I do next? Then I think, well, the river will take you where it will, and you could get stuck on a tree and going, I'm stuck on a tree in my career. I didn't plan my career to be stuck on a tree in the middle of a river. But so life is this river thing. That's the analogy. And I'm there paddling like crazy. And I've built a weird boat. And I'm going to weird parts of the river. And people are going, what's he doing over that part of the river? That's where the French people live. And people think I'm crazy for doing France. But there was a promoter in Paris. And he was saying to me, there's 200,000 English speakers in Paris. Why are you doing it in French? And I was saying, there's 60 million French people in France. Can you not see the big picture here? And there's 80 million in German, or another... 9 in Austria. It's about 90 million Germans I could play to. Spanish, I get the whole of South America. I'm not crazy. I'm keep setting these missions up, and therefore I'm like a 19-year-old saying, come on, I've got to do this. And it didn't take off for me for ages. I was a lot of people in comedy, not until you're in your 30s did it happen. And I was ready when I was 19. I was ready when I was 7. Yeah, it sort of took off around about 30. So I've been playing catch up. What happened to those 10 years? It was Margaret Thatcher's fault, because that was the entire period. When she resigned, suddenly my career took off.
There has to be a connection.
There has to be. It was a horrible 80s. Was just
so. In order to every time you want some type of a career high, we have to sacrifice a Margaret Thatcher. Is that?
Well, I'm not saying that far, but she. Yeah, all this greed is good, and you know Gordon Gekko and the Reagan Thatcher years, and they just wouldn't put any sanctions on South Africa, a racist country, under that administration, and it was all wrong. So I didn't like that decade.
So how do you separate between between your comedy and then you as just as a person, and you, because obviously you care about people and obviously you want the world to be better as much as you can. So why did you make the conscious decision to like just make the stand up about social politics and about bureaucracy, but not necessarily politics?
Because I thought I would go into politics.
Oh.
So I was pre-planning that. I've been planning. I plan about 50 years ahead now. I used to plan about 10 years ahead. But the art of planning is to plan about 50 years ahead and then be able to change tomorrow. Someone could walk in that door now and say, this has just come through. And you go, okay, we're going to stop it. I'm going to cancel the tour. I'm going to do this, which I'm not doing. By the way. But, you know, you have to be prepared to cancel a whole bunch of things and then saying, well, that's going to piss everyone off. Well, we'll pay everyone money. I got another film that came in. I had to pay $100,000. I had to pay $100,000 to do this other film. So I'm happy to do that because I like doing the work. I feel I'm a creativist as opposed to a capitalist. Capitalists make things to make money. I make money to make things.
Yeah.
I love making things. I just love making stuff that wasn't there and then make it happen. And so I'm a creativist.
That's so as long as you're able to just keep making stuff, they go. Why do you think sometimes, or a lot of times, you know, as comics hit, like, they get into their late 60s, 70s, like, comics just get softer. It's like, oh, you want them to be funny, but they just sort of, they just lose. And is it not?
Because it's the edge. I still feel 22. I've got so much to do. I'm working so hard at the moment, and I haven't got a lot of money put aside, so I've got to keep working. And so I feel I'm 22 and just beginning to get there.
The hunger.
Yeah, it's the hunger. I'm like, I came out of 2 months in Berlin, doing stand-up in German, 7 weeks in German of shows, and I was doing dramatic film with Dustin Hoffman and Kathy Bates and Josh Lucas, and that was great. I spent ages trying to get that together, and then I've got 6 years, and then I have to put it all into hibernation to go into politics and do an Al Franken.
And then you're going to do comedy again after the politics?
Yeah, I want to be able to, at the end of a political career, to come out of it. Or even in the middle of a political to come out of, I just don't. I might get sucked in and then I can't get out, or I feel like I've got to stay in because I don't like these people who are pushing and this situation has got into a knot. You know, I love this career. I don't want to leave this place, and I spent decades putting it together, and it's getting really interesting. I mean, God, you know, imagine stand in Moscow and go, hello Moscow, this gig's going to be in Russian. That's going to be beautiful. You know, and all the history that's gone on there, and it's great when you do it in French. I 2,000 seater the Olympia theater where Jacques Brel played, Edith Piaf, Jimi Hendrix, David Bowie, and then I did it, sold it out in French, and that was beautiful. And that was French and British people all working to try and sell it out because all the other performers and actors were going on television saying, c'est nécessaire, il faut voir cet spectacle. You know, you got to go and see it. And I thought, wow, I didn't know these people, and it was. And there's 200 years since the Battle of Waterloo, and then you've got, and there's still this spiky thing that can go on between French and British people, or French and English people. But there's us working together to do this show because we just thought it was good.
Yeah.
And that's beautiful.
Do you ever slow down? Ever? Can you?
I think I speed up, actually. I think this is the time to speed up. I think I met an 80-year-old lion who was 14 years old, but 80 in human years.
Sure.
At Boston Zoo, where they kindly said, come and see a backstage tour of Boston Zoo, which seemed like you go back and you'd see the lions getting ready and tuning up guitars.
Chimps are smoking.
Yeah. Before the big show. But this, we went back and they'd all been outside. This lion was going to come in and we were behind bars, but the lion was yowling, wanted to come in and say hello in a lion, in an 80-year-old lion way. And he basically ran at us and went, blah. And he did a false leap because he knew the bars were there. So he just came up and went, nah. Like, you know, like some kid might do at school. Some big kid might do at school. Blah. You know, just throw something in your face just to scare you. And he thought, wow, you're going to do that and you're 80? So they don't ever stop being fed. All wild animals. This is what I'm going to say. Todos los animales salvajes están en forma. This is the Spanish part of my show. Goes into the fact that it's the Olympian ideal I'm talking about, the healthy mind and a healthy body, which is great. Nazis liked it as well, but they got it wrong because it wasn't a fucked up mind in a healthy body. It was a healthy mind, and they got that a little bit wrong. But the general idea, this Greek ideal, is great. And I always read it and thought, you can't, because as you get older, the body goes nowhere, but the head gets pretty good. When you're a kid, the body is good, but the head's just got nothing in it.
Yeah.
But in fact, if you can try and make both of them work, that is where we should be going. Wisdom in your head and fitness in your body. Otherwise, we could be living to 100, and the last 20 years is just going to be useless. So that's why marathon running, triathlons, do what the wild animals do. You know, get feral with it, baby.
Yeah, because I don't... The marathons are essentially 26 miles a day.
Yes.
For a lot of days.
Yes.
In a row.
Yeah.
But you're not taking...
I'm not saying everyone's going to do that. Just realize if you look at wild animals, which is what we were, and we slowed ourselves down, and we came out of the trees 2 million years ago, we started doing civilization 2,000 years ago, we started eating sugar 400 years ago. Sugar's a big poison, refined sugar. And now we sit and eat cakes and watch stuff. We should be getting out there and running wild like we did when we were kids.
Yeah.
And we just lose this idea. And that's what we've got to get back to. We've got to keep that within our lives. Otherwise, your end part of your life, your end game story is just going to be bad.
Well, I think part of the problem is that, and one of the ways that you're fortunate is that you know what you want. You know what you're passionate about. And I think a lot of people don't know what they're passionate. They get to a certain point in their life, and they're like, I don't fucking know.
No, my dad said he's 85. When's he got 86 in September. He says he still doesn't know what he wants to do when he grows up. He said to me, I was very lucky because I knew at seven, I knew, and it's never, that was acting. That was drama. That was not comedy. I love comedy. I didn't know you could do it. I just saw acting. I saw someone acting and they were getting a lot of applause as well. So it was this affection things. My mother died, swapped that over for the audience. Yeah, that's what I wanted to do. And it's just stayed there like a rock, which is interesting.
Do you make that connection? Do you make the maternal connection between like the open arms of an audience and losing your mom
the
when you were a kid?
Yeah, because just before she died, there was a Christmas thing. I would have been five then. And there was a pattern for a Raven outfit. And so she made this. She cut out the patterns and sewed it together. And she was very ill at this point, but she did that. And so I there's a picture of me dressed as a Raven. And so I played one of two Ravens in the show. And at one point I got a laugh because I said the line back to front, which was supposed to pardon me, your majesty. But I said, I beg your pardon, your majesty, which isn't very funny in my book. But it killed that. I seem to remember it killed. And just because it just sounded like I was being indignant with the queen. Just saying. Anyway, so that happened. And I remember doing that and going, oh, yeah, I did that. That's no big deal. And then my mum died a few months later. And then time went on. And then a year later, I see this thing and say, whoa, God, what's this guy doing on stage? God, these people really like it. I've got to do this. And it just stayed. It stayed. And I did crazy things to try and get into shows. I wasn't in the school choir because that seemed very girly. And I hadn't told everyone I was kind of girly anyway. Because Action Transvestites, we have a lot of boy stuff going on. So I was football, soccer, you know, that. You know, this is what my sexuality is. It's straight transvestite. And it's got all the boy stuff. I wanted to be in the military. I was going to be, in the SAS and all this kind of stuff. But I've also got the girly part. Anyway, so at that point, the choir, you weren't in the choir because that was kind of a more girly place to be. But they were doing Joseph and his Technicolor Dreamcoat, the Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice musical. It's a great, fun musical. And I thought, I need to be in this. So I just stood next to them. So they were doing things to set up because they go, okay, we're in the choir, we're going to do this thing. And I just stood. I just stood there. I just got to wherever they were. And whenever they were doing things, I would just stand there. And then someone says, we need to pick this up. And I would pick things up and I'd move tables around. And gradually, I was just the guy who was always moving things. So I was gradually there. And you're going to help with this, right? Is that okay? And then I was in it. And then I even got a solo line out of it. So I just carved.
Sheer force of will.
Yeah, just by standing around and until they gave in. And that's what a lot of it was. The beginning stuff was, there was a lot of no at the beginning, and it was working how to get around no.
But most people say no in their own heads before they even do something, and then when someone else goes no, they go, oh yeah, that's what I thought, and then they just don't try anymore.
Well, how do you mean the no?
I mean, like, they stop themselves from doing it before, like, they would go, like, a lot of people might go, oh yeah, I'm probably, no one's going to cast me in that thing. Why would they want me in that? You know, like, they, the sort of internal, the critic would deter them before an external force. And then
if they do that, I don't know how to link up with that thinking. Cause there are certain things I think, well, I don't think I should do that. I'm not even going to bother trying, but the things I want to, I say, I need to do that. How do I get into that? And then I just, my brain just goes round and round thinking, how can I get to there? How can I get there? How can I get into the thing?
Those are good questions. Like there are people, I think a lot of people ask bad questions. Like a good question is, how do I make that work? Or how could I manifest that? Or how do I, oh, not this way. Well, is there a back way? How do I get to this? Or what do I want?
Yeah. I mean, the whole computer thing, which, you know, if you look at the Steve Jobs thing, I bought an Oric computer. I don't know if you had them here, but it was the early basic computer we had. There was a Sinclair ZX Spectrum and an Oric computer, and this was about 84. And I was trying to start a computer company. I just thought this games thing is going to take off. And I played Asteroids, which is a very early.
Oh, yeah.
Game, and I was an Asteroid King as I.
Type. So fucking vector graphics. I loved Asteroid.
I worked out how to do it. I got scores of over 1 million. I mean, a standard score, first ever score you'd get would be about 1,000 or something. I got spare rockets all across the top because you get an extra one every 10,000. And the technique most people would do is you shoot out all the rock except for one that you leave floating around, and then you just wait there, and then these little spaceships come who are very accurate.
Yes.
But they will, they're worth 1,000 if you kill them. But I would just zoom around off the edge. So you go horizontally across the screen, and you just keep it at high speed, and you're zooming. So when he shoots you, he can't actually find you because you keep moving. but if you go da-da-da-da-da-da, you can do a spray of about 5 bullets, and he would just drive into your spray and die. And this was, I would play games for an hour and a half.
Jeez.
And it was so odd because I was at the halls of residence, so first year at university. And the people, I would go to the next door halls of residence where I wasn't known at all. Not that I was very well known in my hall of residence. And I would get on the machine, and people would talk about me as if I wasn't there because they thought I was part of the machine. Well, like I'd become part of the machine. They'd go, God, he's really weird. Yeah, that's all he does. Yeah, that's all he kills. But he's perfect. God, look at the number of spaceships he's got. And that was they were sitting right next to me and doing that. And I just thought, this is weird.
So you work shit out. It's the same. Everything you say sounds like it. I mean, like it all comes from the same mind. It's the guy who figures out how to run 40 marathons, or the guy who figures out Asteroids, the guy who figures out Spanish in 2 weeks. I mean, there's something about. How do you unbox a situation and start getting underneath it to understand it to then ultimately
And it all comes from the transvestite thing where I sort of analyze myself to work out, you know, should I come out? Yes, I should come out. And I don't think I should have shame or guilt. I think that's been put upon me. And if people have a problem with my sexuality, then they can see a psychiatrist and the psychiatrist can help them with their problem.
Well, how did you arrive at that? Because most people don't. Most people are afraid.
I lay on my bed with the curtains closed, and I just kept thinking, why do I feel this way? And and my brain was stopping me thinking. It was like a damaged place in my head, so like a car crash thing. So, it would not let me concentrate. So I just kept working on it, and I didn't get to any big conclusion of the why. And since then, I've just come to the conclusion: it's in my genetics. It's in there. They will find. The transvestite, transsexual, transgender, genetic, they'll find a code in there, and then you'll find, you know, people will have that, and I'll have that. But I just thought it's better to be honest and upfront about it. The only way you can get to a better place is coming out. That seems the right way to do it. It could screw up my career. I don't even have a career, but, you know, that could knacker it in the head. Well, you just got to get it out there and see where the chips may lie. And it seemed positive. And that is that day I walked out the door. That informs everything else. Because it takes anyone, LGBT, it takes that balls, guts, whatever it is to get out. And once you've done it, you can start to get positive about it. And somebody said to me it was a gift. I was at this help group. This guy said, it's a gift. I went, what? It's not a gift. Oh, well, that's an interesting way of looking at it. And since then, I've tried to work it. It is actually a gift. If you're alternative sexuality, it is a gift. It's a tricky gift. It's a double-edged gift. You've got to get out. You've got to get positive with it. But then you can see things in a different way. And it's a genetic gift that has been given to me. I don't believe in the gods, so it was my share of the cards. We all get these genetic cards. Someone can play piano. Some people have very dark ones. I think we all have some dark ones, some light ones, some good ones, some help. I'm really good at running. I'm good at fishing, whatever it is. And they're just given to us. And then there's others we can work on from those basic genetics.
So. And it's so, I feel like that realization was so important, particularly to comedy, because you, as a comic, the best comics are know who they are. That's, I feel like that's part of the comic's journey, is like the longer you do comedy, the more you know who you are, the more, because you're constantly, you analyze the external world and then you start analyzing your internal world. It's like, oh, this is who I am and I'm going to but you knew that from a young age.
Well, on the sexuality thing, I sensed it from 4 and didn't articulate it until 19, I think. No, 21 when I first... at 19 I tried to see a doctor about it in university, and 21 I told someone about it, and 23 I came out. So that was in there. That was just, but I was all this, you know, boys, soccer, military, all this very boy stuff going on, and then there's this girly thing as well. But I just didn't know what to do with it, and I was actually going to keep it secret forever. You know, it didn't seem like at all positive. And then I realized this, it's the Arthurian quest. We are Arthurian knights. It's the way to think about it. If you are LGBT, you've got to think of yourself as Arthurian knight, and you've got to get your guts together, and your quest is to get out, tell people, and try and make a positive place for yourself, and then if anyone else can be positive with that, that's great, and live in the world.
And did it ever occur to you, like, someday that's going to be one of my defining traits that people will be inspired by and actually think is pretty cool?
No, I never... And I didn't want to be a poster child either. I just wanted to say, this is where I've got to on it. And if you can swing with that, that's great. And if anyone else is, you know, alternative sexuality, they can grab hold of that. And but it has got to a more positive place. And if I, you know, if and when I get elected, which is 2020 when I'm going for election, that will be another positive move forward. And gay and lesbian communities have moved things a lot further forward since the 50s. Transgender is still... We're playing catch up with the poor relations. And my nails here that people can't see on radio podcasts, but I got British European transvestite. That's the political state.
That Union Jack flag looks fucking great.
So it's the Union Jack here, and that's the European flag there. So it's like African American, Italian American, I'm British European, and then the others are just painted red. And somebody said to me, well, I see the British bit, I see the European bit. What's the transvestite bit? I said, well, I've painted my fucking nails, man. it was a perfect joke. It's such an odd thing to say.
But I like that I really, really like, as we're sort of winding down here, because I don't want to monopolize all your time, but this idea that you do have this long-term plan, but there is the flexibility to be okay with moments happening, just because I read that you discovered you were an atheist literally on stage, where you just went, and then you were just, you rolled with it, like all of these decisions where you just grapple, and then you go, oh yeah, no, this is how it is now.
I think that is what when I decided just to define it. I think I'd been... a lot of people go to agnostic and say, well, just in case the guy comes down. and that's what you want to do. So you go up there and say, yeah, I was never sure. But yeah, I'm much more sure. Because you turn up, you know. And that used to be my joke. But then I just thought, stop pissing about. I don't believe there's any one thing, man, woman, ham sandwich, whatever it is, running the gig. And if they are, I think a Stephen Dawkins line is, if there is a God, who created God? And then if that other person created God, so he must be God. And then who created him? Was that a hamster? And was it a hamster that's God? You know, who created the only thing that makes sense is the randomness of eternalness, which is why Nazis can get into power, which is why the death counts, which is why great days and rock concerts and you know, nice salads and the beauty and the horror that we have in our world only makes sense from randomness, not from some divine plan of someone saying, I'm going to have a lot of hellish things and I got some salads as well. that doesn't make any sense. It stuff goes on. That's why we, the moderate people of the world, we've got to stay vigilant, because some people, I don't know whether genetically or whatever, how they've grown up in their life, but they want to come in and tear things down. And most of us are just live and let live, but sometimes these extremists get in, and it could be religious or political, and you just have to watch it, and you have to stay activist. And in, you know, 2010 election, you did was it 10 or was it 14? Where are we now? Coming up to 14. So it was the 12.
Yeah.
The 12 one. That was great because it looked like it was going to be really tough. And then you got in, you know, Barack Obama got back in. Well, so it's a two-term. A black man has been in for two terms. So there's black people around the world going, well, this is different. No matter what happens, no matter what obfuscation, is that the word? The Tea Party put in, trying to block ideas going through. It's still there. It's written down now, you know. And if Hillary runs in the next, what is it going to be?
Couple years,
16.
Yeah.
Yeah, that'll be very interesting. And, you know, so, yeah, there's a lot of positive stuff out there in the world. And I'm still, you know, glass is two-thirds full for me.
You just like to shake it up every once in a while.
Well, I just want to keep pushing things forward because you've got to push forwards. Otherwise, the negative people will drag things back and it'll all be about money. And then the wonderful things about America will seem like the old stuff about the old hierarchical Europe that people left for. You know, if money can run politics, then you why did everyone leave Europe when it was the money running politics? We've got money out of most of our politics. That's the amazing thing. We don't have all this money sloshing around. We don't have any adverts on telly that say, do this. You have big billboards. There's a certain amount of money, but you've just got tons of money. It's all gone weird.
When do you know at what point when you're grappling with something like, oh, fuck it, I'm just going to let it go, or can you not let something go until you have
material wise?
Anyway, I'm interested. I think your comedy, having just talking to you, is one piece of the engine that is your brain, which I am very fascinated by, because you keep coming up against all these things where most people go, oh, I can't do that. And you go, no, I'll just tear this open and figure it out, and here's how it is, and I'll be flexible, but I have this plan, and I'm going to stay on this path, and you know, but I can take left and right turns here and there. I'm interested in how you problem solve.
I was always quite determined. I think when you're growing up, you will feel there's certain things you can do naturally. And then some people say, well, I can do these naturally, so that's what I will do. And the rest of the things I obviously can't do. But I have found that if you want to do something else that's maybe like the natural thing, or maybe it's some way from the natural thing, but you really want to do this other thing, you can actually build and develop a version of yourself that can do that. Dramatic acting was something I really wanted to do from 7, and then I got into comedy, and then I felt, well, I've developed all these comedy muscles. How do I do dramatic acting? And I had to unlearn it. So I thought, I'll just block all my comedy signals. And so my early dramatic pieces were just not good because there was almost nothing going on. Because I said, I'm not going to do the comedy version. Bottom line of drama is to be truthful. Bottom line of comedy is to be funny. And you can be funny and be truthful. And that could be a very poignant comedy film. Little Miss Sunshine, there you go. There's a lot of comedic stuff going on there. But in the end, all the characters line down into truth. And you could be truthful in drama and be funny as well. But you've got to be truthful in drama. That's the bottom line. It's got to all line up. And I had to train myself to do that. And I got very much into technique. I didn't go to drama school, so I've got to learn all this technique. And then I was too much in my head and not in the moment. And being in the moment is completely key. For drama, comedy, politics, be in the moment rather than... That's what people really respond to, and particularly say in politics. If someone can be there and living and breathing and saying, I feel this because that happened, rather than being perfectly on message, perfectly delivering the lines, and here's another set of lines, and you know, that's, they want people to be real. Remember when it was Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, and they said, and then she was emotional at one point. They said, well, this is what we want to see. We want to see people being emotional. You've got to be like a fortress in politics, but you've also got to be open to be emotional. And to be able to feel people's pain, or to be positive and happy when, or to pull people up, or you know, say, "Come on, it's okay. We're going to make this." And so, yeah, being in the moment is very key. But I find that I have analytical in one hand and instinctive in the other. So work on your instincts, but work on your analytical. Your analytical can open up things that you didn't realize you could do, and then you can actually learn to do them. And then it can be like, well, this person can naturally do that. I wasn't a good stand-up when I started, so apparently now I'm quite good. You know, I feel I'm pretty good. But I was a street performer. I was a terrible street performer. Then I became an okay, and then I'm a pretty good street performer. You can learn to do the thing. Maybe not to world-class standards, but you can develop versions of yourself that has all the working bits that can do problems that, or do... activities that you didn't think you could do.
Can you thrive without an obstacle? Like, do you need, because all these things that you conquer, it's like, oh, well, I have to break that thing down. It's an obstacle, and break through it and figure it out. If something would just was very easy, was that boring to you?
If I had, because I love making films and I haven't made my own films yet. And so if I had the thing that I didn't have all these obstacles and just to make those films, I'd be fine with that. I'd rather not have all the obstacles. That won't be boring. My obstacles then would be creative obstacles or creative problems of trying to make everything sync, work, and be good. I do want it to be interesting and have an edge. But I can't. Yeah, it's a difficult one to answer that one. I think I'd like it without the problems. But then you only learn from failure. You don't learn from success. So I've had a good slice of failure in my life.
Well, the danger that some people run, I notice a lot of times, it's like, am I creating fires to put them out? Because I'm so in the mode of having to stamp things out. Am I creating problems because I just have to solve problems?
I don't think I do that, but I do know that once I've done an intense period of work, once I stop, I go, isn't there anything I have to do now? But there's always something to do because there's always, there's always emails to answer or something or the problems from way back. But I don't know. Yeah, trying to just be at peace, that's a tricky thing. I'm not brilliant at just being at one and calm.
I think that's okay too. I think that's just one of the options of states of being is like, I'm just zen all the time about everything. I'm like, well, that's a choice, but I kind of like being in the mix all the time.
Do like doing things.
Well, this has been great. I hope you had fun.
Yeah, no, it's always good.
Please come back anytime.
Absolutely.
And Force Majeure, when are you, the tour starts?
30th of April in DC. It's on eddieizzard.com. And it goes up to the 2nd in San Antonio, in 2nd of July in San Antonio. So it's Texas, Chicago down to Texas and everything east of that. But not every state, but I'm going to get to every state if I possibly can on this tour later in the year or beginning next year.
Excellent. Because I think a lot of people don't, the touring business is tricky, and some people are like, what? How could you not come to dot, dot, dot? And you're like, well, it's not that simple. The venue has to be available. There's a lot of certain things that have to happen for these dates to fall into place. It has to work in the schedule. It's got to work in the mapping. And so it's never an intentional thing that's like, ah, fuck all those dates. But it's a process to string that many shows together at once.
Yeah.
So, all right. Good to see you, man. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.